put that rumor to rest. However, if you would like a tasty, wonderful, portable way, and much less expensive than your designer supplement, you can get Panda is a wonderful company, and actually there's real licorice in here. Sad to say, and you can look for yourself, if you go in the conventional food store, go to the candy section, find what looks to be licorice, and you read the label, you'll see there's no licorice in there whatsoever. But these guys do put licorice extract in here and a few other all healthy things, no preservatives, no additives. Kids love it too, so it's another wonderful thing if you're trying to get your kids off a lot of sugar and candy. This would be another wonderful thing to introduce to them. But primarily for digestive purposes, soothing the throat, acid reflux, it's a wonderful way to go. And not expensive, and as I said, very portable. You can take it to the office. You just have to be careful because everybody's going to be over in your section taking your licorice out of your Panda box, and you won't have any left, so you got to hide it in a drawer somewhere. Licorice, a very important remedy.
Okay, I wanted to share those segments for, you know, because one, everybody's interested in what can they do to take in anti-cancer preventative measures. And a lot of times, the sort of designer supplements or that sort of market out there that capitalizes on this, it's really out of reach financially for so many of us to consistently take these supplements. And I can't even tell you how expensive selenium supplements are. The last time I looked at them was like maybe 10 years ago, and I almost dropped the bottle when I saw how expensive it was. So this is truly revolutionary because Brazil nuts are such a phenomenal source of selenium, and it's really like pennies that you're paying on the dollar compared to buying a trace mineral like selenium, which is so expensive.
Well, you know, Natalie, the disheartening thing to me is that natural medicine became a big business.
Absolutely.
And that's what I'm trying to get away from with this DVD set, and is to get back to the real.
And I know
get away from the profiteering and all the...
Absolutely. And I just have to say the number one more time for the people who are moving away from the radio, 212-209-2950. It is Natural Medicine and Survivor's Guide. We just broke it down in the anti-cancer segment about how to get one of those most powerful traces.
And this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And we are moving from recorded materials to a live program with equipment that may or may not be working. We'll find out. Stay tuned.
Buy this stuff.
Well, so far, not very successful, is it? Okay, maybe if I push this. Oh, that does it. Good. As I said, stay tuned. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a, well, should be weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, we will continue the effort to try to raise some money, but also we'll be talking with Daniel Persons, who's going to be reviewing The Martian momentarily. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I'm suspecting there are a lot of people who loved Star Trek The Next Generation who are equally in love with Ridley Scott's new film, The Martian. There are a lot of parallels there. As in Next Gen, the premise presents us with a dilemma. In this case, Matt Damon's astronaut, who goes by the name of Watney, is stranded on an abandoned Mars base, with hope for rescue years away. His plight brings out the best not only in him, but in the crewmates who mistakenly abandon him, and in Earthbound humanity in general, all of whom set aside personal concerns, philosophical differences, national divides, the Chinese play a big role eventually, to bring our boy home. This is lovely. This is optimistic. It's also, as when Next Gen was most orthodox in adhering to Gene Roddenberry's idealistic vision of humankind's future, a little dull. Ridley Scott, the guy who directed Alien, Blade Runner, not to mention Thelma and Louise and Gladiator, isn't really known for doing optimism, and his approach to it lacks the nuance that would give us a glimpse into the humanity of the characters experiencing these events. When disaster befalls Watney, and there's no shortage of disaster that befalls Watney, dust storms, equipment failure, depletion of the ketchup supply, etc., etc., he squares his shoulders, sets his jaw, makes a flip little joke about the situation, and soldiers on. And that's generally true about all the characters here. They have to, of course. Watney's survival affords no other option. But at the risk of sounding obnoxious, when I broke my leg a few years ago, my narrative was not dissimilar. I made my decisions about my medical treatment, although in my case they were as much based on hope and guesswork as informed knowledge. I had to bide my time during a healing process that extended into months, and I had to make a concerted effort, despite my natural proclivity to inertia, to perform the steps that would ensure my rehabilitation. To all external appearances, I was Watney. Inside, though, I was a mass of fears, anger, and doubt, all of which were sublimated in service of achieving my mission goal. The Martian gets all the exterior stuff right. In some ways, the film feels like Ridley Scott is apologizing for Prometheus by making sure that all behavior and decisions are thoroughly plausible given the situation. But the interior aspect, the part that would give value to what these people have to surrender to achieve their goals, that bit is wanting. There's a lot that's wonderful about The Martian. The supporting cast, which includes Jeff Daniels, Jessica Chastain, Donald Glover, Kristen Wiig, Sean Bean, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and on, all deliver colorful, appealing performances. The production is great, both the practical settings and the computer-generated effects. Never did I doubt that what I saw on the screen physically existed, whether it actually did or not. And the final rescue sequence is nothing short of fantastic. Whatever checks the film writes up to that point are paid off with interest at the end. The Martian is a sterling example of pure science fiction storytelling, the kind where science and its deployment are a cornerstone to the story's solution, and that does call for respect. That I didn't get something more out of it, something that gave me insight into our existence as humans, has me withholding my unconditional love. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair, but her mommy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seats with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools if they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Take a look at the old man beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on Mars? On America's tortured brow that Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow. Now the workers have struck for fame, 'cause Lennon's on sale again. See the mice in their million hordes, from Ibiza to the Norfolk Broads. Blue Britannia is out of bounds to my mother, my dog, and clowns. But the film is a sad thing for, 'cause I wrote it 10 times or more. It's about to be writ again, as I ask you to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. It's a freakiest show. Take a look at the old man beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if he'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on Mars?
Part of the question is there life here on WBAI in New York City? And we will find out. I know I'm here, but our phone line doesn't seem to have a dial tone, so I couldn't call our guest. So we're trying to Skype this. Daniel, I think that you're on. Can you say something if you hear me? Okay, well, this does seem to be slightly problematic and not not quite sure how we're definitely connected, but perhaps he cannot hear me. Now, I know that he's also listening on his radio, which will have a bit of a time lag involved, but while we're coming up on the computer, I don't see it coming up here. My, my, my. Well, what do you think? No, there's no other way to test this out than on the air. I will be using my cell phone to give Daniel a call and see what we can do about this. Yes, I can hear you on my phone, but not on the air. You can hear me through the Skype. Aha, okay. Well, that's lovely. Now all we need to do is get you on the air. And Yeah, there's often a lag on Skype. I have often found this because it is, after all, internet-to-internet calling, and internet always involves some kind of a lag. So, no, I suspect the issue is on this end, like choosing the correct sound card or something like that. Let's see, audio settings. Yeah, I can see that I am coming through. Let me try this. Talk to me.
Am I here? Can you hear me?
I believe I can. Try that again.
Hello, people.
Yes, it's working. It's working. It's working.
Hello, people of the Audio Radiance.
Okay, I'm going to hang up the phone now.
Okay, me too.
And good morning, Daniel.
Good morning. How are you? That was fun.
Oh, yes, it was. Okay, so the trick was to change the speaker's setting. And lo and behold, this is vaguely working.
That's wonderful.
And I had to start from scratch because there weren't, as far as I could tell, this program has never been set up to work before. So
it's an adventure. It's like the early days of radio, isn't it?
Well, sorry.
Can you hear us, Berlin?
Indeed, indeed. Come here, Watson. I need you. At any
that's a little too far back.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, I am Jim Freund. This is allegedly Hour of the Wolf, and with me is Daniel Persons, who is our generally weekly movie reviewer. We are going to have Randy Dawn here as well, who has started doing some reviews, but it was a difficult night for her. You know, coming in live at this hour is not necessarily an easy thing. So,
Randy and I have been passing MASH notes back and forth on Facebook. So,
very good. Very good. So she'll be on tentatively November 11th, both talking about media, but primarily about the fact that she's also a science fiction writer and publicist and representative and stuff like that there. So, but I thought that this morning, first of all, we do have a premium for people to call and pledge. And no, it's not $150. It's not $45. It's $25.
Wow.
And we're giving them you, Daniel.
Well, you know, I'll have to check my calendar.
Yeah, indeed. But you know, we can straighten that out with all the people that will be subscribing. But everybody listening just heard an example of Daniel, except me, heard an example of Daniel's review of The Martian. And and we have, well, I don't know how many. We have more than dozens. I don't know if we've quite reached 100 yet.
I think we have at this point, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, let me see. I've got all your files right here because this is what will become. No, a mere 81.
Ah, by the end of the year.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, but that at least was relatively easy to do because I have, more or less the premium that we're talking about right here. And it's a lot of fun listening to different movie reviews and everything from her to Ernest and Celestine, which I thought was wonderful. The Hobbit, yeah, tentpole movies, and some not so tenty. Indeed.
I'm stepping out of the tent more and more often these days.
Yeah, and I like that, actually, I must say. Genevieve Valentine, when she was doing reviews for us, and yes, we'll include those, I don't think she ever reviewed a movie that I had heard of. And they were eye-openers, I must say. Kumari, which is on Netflix, is well worth finding out about. And as I said, nobody's really likely to have heard of that. So, what we thought we would talk about as we encourage people to join WBAI by calling...
By the way, you should explain by what medium you're distributing me.
It's probably a CD.
Okay.
I give the sound to WBAI. They will fulfill it somehow. It'll be MP3 files, and they will be getting it either could be WAV files because that's what you send me. But generally, BAI reduces things to MP3 files, and it will either be an audio CD or an MP3 CD or a thumb drive with MP3 files. Can be any of the above.
You won't know until you get it. It's a mystery.
It's a mystery, indeed. And we've actually moved a few in the past, but, you know, I've never actually been involved in the fulfillment. So,
you've never had a fulfilling experience?
As it were. Well, it's WBAI. At any rate, now that we have this working, I think that I have to leave for a minute.
Oh.
And take care of, I don't think Lister's supposed to be scheduled to be on, but probably nobody told him that. So why don't we, I can either play another piece of music, or we can play one of your reviews.
It's the host's call, of course. I would love to hear what that cunning scamp Dan Persons has to say about any film.
Okay, well, why don't you name a film that you've done?
Oh, why don't you run the title will come back to me, The Midnight Swim, because that's a very unusual film.
You know, it's funny because I was just looking at that, of course, then I stopped looking at it. So,
yes.
Lost where it is. There it is. Fine. We will do that, and I'll ask you, I don't know if I even have a mute here, so just...
I shall stay very, very quiet, a little mouse. You won't even know I'm here.
Okay, you do that, and we'll be back after this Midnight Swim.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. We tend to take for granted, when watching a movie, the objectivity of the camera. It's a tool, after all, a machine whose only function is to capture what's placed in front of it. It has no investment in anything it observes. That assumption is automatic. We don't consciously consider it, and it's the thing that in part leads to stuff like the put-down-the-damn-camera syndrome in found-footage mockumentary horror films, those moments when the character wielding the camera keeps filming when, logically, he should just drop the thing and get his buttocks out of there. There are a couple of small but notable moments in the new found footage ghost story, The Midnight Swim. In one, a woman, June, played by Lindsay Burge, films her two sisters, the pragmatic Annie, played by Jennifer LaFleur, and the more impulsive Isa, played by Alexa Palladino, as they meet with a real estate agent to sell their home in the wake of their mother's mysterious disappearance while diving into the lake behind the house. The two on-camera sisters have differing opinions about whether to sell, but even as June proclaims she's taking no sides, she pushes her camera into the agent's face, a passive-aggressive assault that visibly disturbs the woman. Later on, the three sisters are having breakfast in the dining room while the camera sits on a tripod. June, oddly, is barely visible, hanging off the edge of the frame, and when Isa begins to accuse Annie of hypocrisy for trying to invoke some kind of familial bond between the three of them, and an argument ensues, June stands and picks up the camera to get close-ups of the quarreling women. This could have been a practical consideration. Director Sarah Dina Smith, who also wrote the script, orchestrating this move to get her close-ups without cheating cuts, although she has no problem cheating elsewhere. But note again, the camera takes June's part, becomes an extension of her character rather than just a passive recording device. This becomes important as the film progresses and strange time-lapse shots of the lake begin to show up, shots that June swears she was not responsible for. Found footage has become overall a thoroughly debased genre. It's used more now to cover a lack of budget or to permit filmmakers to slack off on intelligent plotting or decent cinematography. Director Smith has broken the mold through a number of gambits, that unusual blurring of character and camera for one, for another that the film overall is beautifully photographed, no technical shortcuts here, and another is that she essentially ignores the pretense to documentary, even more than so-called mockumentaries that somehow manage to work in very undocumentary background music and editing styles. The supposedly impromptu footage, some of which may actually have been improvised, is used more for impressionistic purposes. There's even a lip-synced music video thrown in. And the story, taking in myths both classic and local, and the mother's scientific research into the strange effects the apparently bottomless lake has on mind and body, places a premium on enigma and on the personal dynamics of the three sisters. It's not completely seamless. Smith throws in a fake-out scare moment that's straight out of the Horror 101 textbook. There are details about the sisters' backgrounds that are abruptly invoked when some sort of audience priming would have given them more impact. And towards the end, two of the sisters behave in a way that makes little sense beyond setting up the third sister for a final, fateful act. The film will not sit well with some. If you were annoyed in general by Lost, and in particular by its finale, you'll probably have your patience tested by The Midnight Swim's ambiguities. As for me, I found it a rare, beautiful, emotionally gripping exploration of the supernatural. And I'm sure glad nobody decided to put down the camera. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website. So check out what you missed by going to MightyMoviePodcast.com.
Okay, well, that seems to have worked. Not, one has to sort of run up and down stairs here. Too often have I found myself in these facilities all by myself. But
you get your exercise.
You get your exercise. When I say these facilities, I include past WBAIs, such as 120 Wall Street, not long after the fall of the towers. That was a quite an experience, looking out the window of BAI, knowing I was one of maybe five people in that entire building that had a truck outside for a battery, and looking down at an army camp. It was quite something. Right on Wall Street. Anyway, so I didn't get to hear too much of your review because I was being frantic. But sounds like you liked it and didn't love it.
No, actually, I liked it quite a lot. There were a few flaws in it, but what I respected about it and what I admire about it was that it found a new context for the found footage film. It was trying something new.
We're talking about different films. I was talking about The Martian.
Oh, The Martian. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, the Midnight Swim I heard the review of.
Yeah.
The Martian I did not.
Yeah, as far as The Martian is concerned, yes, you're right. I liked it. I was not in love with it. It was sort of the same thing that I had when I saw Mad Max Fury Road. I went into it already primed because you can't completely seal yourself off from hearing the opinions of others and the opinions of reviewers and getting the buzz one way or another. So I, similar to Mad Max Fury Road, I went into this knowing that a lot of people really, really dug the film. And unlike Mad Max Fury Road, I was more on the fence with this. I have a higher regard, I think, for Ridley Scott than you do.
Well, you know, I think that he has definitely an eye for fabulous visuals. I think that he is captivating visually and all that. But I think that he basically continues to fall down on story pretty much every single time. There's not, for a man who has had so much success, I don't believe he has had one movie that I personally would call a four-star film.
I would give him Blade Runner, of course. I would give him Alien.
I would give Blade Runner a 3 because, and I've had this argument so many times on the air, but I will point out to people that basically the premise makes no sense. You have these replicants on Earth because, or rather these replicants being sent out because there aren't enough people. And yet, we're looking at an overly crowded but beautifully conceived Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Right there, we have an issue.
It's interesting that you say beautifully conceived because it is supposed to be a dystopic type of Los Angeles, but every time I've seen it, there is a part of me that said, I would like to be there.
Yes, so would so many people. It's supposed to be dystopic, and yet it is intentionally modeled very much after the city of Metropolis.
Mm-hmm.
They used the sketches and improved upon them and took on from there. Mm-hmm. As far as the urban sprawl of the movie is concerned, we pretty much already have that in a lot of places. And as for the crime, yeah. And aside from all that, it has not that too many movies do, but it has little or nothing to do with its source material.
Which is typical. And I think since you are something of a diehard Dickian, aren't you?
Yeah.
I don't know about
diehard, but I'm a huge fan of Dick's. I also know his shortcomings, which are many in both writing and life.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Not just being that deeply immersed into Dick myself. God, that's a strange sentence.
Yes, but you know, one has to judge the movie on its own.
Yes.
By its own terms. Yeah. And I have looked at the director's cut version, the one that Alan Ladd Jr. did not screw around with. Mm-hmm. It didn't really improve it all that much. I think it works as a series of set pieces.
I think it's more than that. I think the director's cut, and you know what? I have the Blade Runner box set right here, which is, of course, delivered to you in the Voight-Kampff carrying case.
Right.
But what it's called is the final cut. That's the actual definite last time, whoa boy, this is it, no fooling cut. And I it may be a question of degree, but I do think
I've seen all five cuts. I have the same DVD.
Ah, okay.
Or a series of DVDs.
Yeah. It's a question of degree, but I do think it's better.
In the
final version, and definitely with the ending that's provided, that
restored, yeah.
That, yeah, instead of the happy fairy tale, and as much of a happy fairy tale as you can get.
And you
in
can
this
tell how tacked on that is, because you can't see either Sean Young or Harrison Ford. You just see a car.
Right.
And a noir-like voiceover.
And the outtakes from The Shining.
More or less, yeah.
No, the aerial footage that's used in the ending for the happy ending,
mm-hmm.
That's outtakes from The Shining.
Is it really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes. But getting back
to Ridley Scott in general.
Yeah, Ridley Scott in general. I do like his work. I do feel that there is sort of the Ridley Scott who's the stylist, and at times you see the Ridley Scott who's the hired gun, and which isn't to say that he becomes a bad filmmaker then, but it is to say that there are certain films that he brings his stylistic approach to the table and certain films that he does not. And in comparison, Prometheus was the stylist, Ridley Scott, and so there was a lot of beautiful imagery there. I'll grant Prometheus that, but the story was horrible and the characters were dumb, as opposed to The Martian, which isn't as much a stylistic exercise. And I get the sense that he was brought in on this, and as I say in the review, this is essentially an optimistic film in the Star Trek mold about human beings coming together and becoming greater than themselves, and that isn't particularly a Ridley Scott specialty.
No, it isn't. He tends to be darker than that, but it depends on what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, most of his films end up, you know, Gladiator, whichever.
What this did remind me of, it reminded me of two things. One was the films from the 1950s, like the George Pal film Destination Moon.
Ah. Uh-huh.
And also, and I think I've got the magazine right, because it's been a long time since I've read anything from it, Analog.
Mm-hmm.
The type of science fiction, that hard science fiction, where the stories were really about applying the science to the problem over and above developing compelling characters or nuanced characters.
Yeah, and while I love hard science fiction, the two of them can be mated well and all too frequently are not. But I would point out, speaking of Mars, that Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy is very hard science fiction, very hard insofar as it all makes sense, although dealing with what we found out about Mars, between the time he wrote it and by the time the third book came out, we learned new things about the permafrost, and of course now there's water and all that. But having said that, Stan Robinson, write some of the most compelling hard science fiction in which he never sacrifices character or story or whatever for his science. And the better science fiction writers, hard science fiction writers, don't lose sight of that.
Right. I'm not saying it can't be done.
I'm
not saying it isn't done frequently, but a lot of what I remember from my readings of Analog, a lot of the stories there tended to sacrifice, I felt.
Yeah, and that may or may not be depending on the story laid at the feet of the editor.
Yeah.
But, you know, whether we're talking Stan Schmidt, Ben Bovo is pretty good, and as was Schmidt. But, they're pulling from a smaller field, fantasy or science fiction that doesn't pay much attention to the science has given way overall to stylistic writing.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that is very good, that all of a sudden science fiction discovered prose. we're at the 50th anniversary of the publication of the novel Dune, and you don't read Dune for great prose. Okay, Frank Herbert certainly knew how to turn pages and all that. And Dune is absolutely hard science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great example of it. And when you talk about movies, Metropolis certainly was, even Forbidden Planet.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to give up one for the other. Analog is the magazine that specializes in hard SF. But it's hardly the only place that publishes it, including Clark's World and Lightspeed and Asimov's and the other magazines that are out there today. You can always find good examples of it in film occasionally.
Yeah. The Martian, as far as I'm concerned, is possibly the hardest science fiction I've ever seen in film. I think there are few films that adhere so rigidly to the idea of science solving all the problems and treating the science seriously.
Yeah. But does it have to be the science that solves the problem? For example, just to throw one out, 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the other film that I think and most people would hold up as a hard science fiction film until actually you get to the end of the film when it gets very metaphysical.
Yes, but metaphysics is a part of science.
Well, that's true.
And this was very, very important to Kubrick, although not as much to Clark. And that's funny because it's Clark who's the hard science fiction writer and Kubrick who was the, actually in many ways he was a realist, but the visionary, I think, is there. They were both visionaries, but it was Clark who was the mystic.
Mm.
On 2001, more so than Kubrick. And, Childhood End goes there. So many of his works go there. I'll name another one. Both versions of Solaris.
That's a good one, too. Let me draw a distinction with The Martian, because what The Martian tries to do in all of these, in all of the other films that we're talking about here, and this was the general rule that I learned about science fiction too, the thing that makes it science fiction is that there's science within it, but then there is a level of conjecture that is not necessarily supported by science. So you're talking about extraterrestrial intelligence. You're talking about faster than light.
Faster than light
propulsion.
Faster than light propulsion is unlikely. Time travel is impossible.
Right. But
and
that
the moment
but,
you invoke
but the existence
either.
Of those in the story is what then makes the science fiction possible. Whereas with The Martian, there is no conjectural leap there.
Yeah,
it is all supposed to be science. It is set in the future. I guess you could say that we're possibly the greatest conjectural leap is that they actually have an enclosed biosphere that's self-sustaining, which we haven't been able for an extended period of time that we haven't been able to get yet.
Yeah, but that's really only a matter of time.
That's a matter of time. That's
yeah.
true.
Yeah, I mean, certain scientific principles make, well, actually, FTL, faster than light travel, is arguable because Einstein said it was impossible, but Einstein also did not deal much with the quantum universe.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of the space warp, there actually is a scientific idea behind warp, which is Carl Sagan used to explain it. So did Asimov. Asimov would take a piece of paper, put a dot at one end, a dot at the other end, and then take the two dots, fold the paper.
Yeah, right. Much lauded Wrinkle in Time.
Well, yeah. Let's not invoke that because that's a fantasy novel.
Yeah.
And fantasy movie, and in fact another one in the works now, I understand. But it's reasonable hard science. Space folds.
Yeah.
Light bends.
I know. I think the last I heard, they had actually achieved getting a particle to go faster than light.
No, they haven't quite done that.
They haven't? Not yet? Okay, maybe.
No, nothing yet has gone faster than light. And it's still a questionable kind of thing. The LHC is experimenting with, the Higgs boson and various things. They're dealing more with elemental science. Mm-hmm. But they have produced the fastest speeds that anything can do. And no, we have not yet proven that anything can travel faster than light. I think they're amazed that they can get something like a quarter of the speed of light.
In any case, as The Martian is concerned, the whole idea of the film, and I'm presuming the whole idea of the book that the film was based on.
Which I've only read a portion of. I haven't gone through the whole book.
Right. This is all based. It's on real scientific principle.
Well, all science fiction is. Once
again, there is that conjectural leap that has to be made. That
yeah,
doesn't
but the conjecture
have to be made, but
in
it's
hard,
usually made.
In hard science fiction, it's generally based on
science fiction, yes.
Yes. Well, that's what we're talking about. It's hard science fiction here. And for many, many years, that was almost the totality of science fiction. It's only in the last 20 years or so that we've moved away at all.
What's interesting about the film, I didn't mention this in the review, and I had been thinking about including it because it sort of caught my attention, and it's a very minor moment. But near the beginning of the film, he has to, relatively near the beginning of the film, he has to come up with a way of creating, I believe it's either oxygen or water to support the plants that he's trying to grow. in order to feed himself. And he needs to have some kindling to start up the system, the catalytic system that he hopes will create the air or the water. And there is, as he's puzzling over this dilemma, there are a few shots of him toying with a crucifix, okay? And eventually turns out, I don't know if this is in the book, eventually turns out that he uses the crucifix, which is wood, to create the kindling that will start up the catalytic system. But the fact that there is a crucifix present in the film is interesting because the film is so hard science. And given the fact that Ridley Scott, for whatever he does, is essentially a commercial filmmaker, and the fact that the Chinese play a role in the film, at least from what I've read, is because the studios have discovered that if they bring the Chinese into their story, it results in big box office in China.
Right.
So Ridley Scott is a commercial filmmaker, and I was wondering if we've gotten to the state where the people say, well, too much science is going to raise alarms with a certain hardcore political segment of the society, so we have to have some sort of nod towards God in there, one way or another.
The argument between, you know, pure science and pure religion, as to name another hard science fiction film, Contact, the question of faith and whether the two are compatible or not is usually very popular with filmmakers because they don't want, for the most part, religious organizations decrying something. Yeah. And if it's pure science, they automatically assume that it's anti-faith.
Yeah, yeah. And I suspect that the crucifix made its appearance to cover their butts for that.
Very possibly, to say, yeah, just so that they can back off and say, no, it happened because he had faith. Very likely. I haven't read the book and I haven't seen the movie, so I'm a little disadvantaged.
Yeah.
Right.
But you know what? I'm not really a gambling man, but I would come close to betting that even if there was a crucifix in the book, it was presented in a more ironic fashion than they do in the film.
I don't know. I don't know enough about Andrew Weir,
I don't
who wrote
know
the book. The one thing I do know, which makes it fascinating, is, of course, that the book is self-published.
Huh. Oh, that I didn't know.
And that alone makes the existence of this movie very interesting.
So maybe this was like 50 Shades of Grey. Maybe it started out as fan fiction and then was...
Well, not fan
fiction. Yeah, yeah.
That's an intuitive one has leap. To be very careful. You know, that's a whole other major topic about when something is self-published, what qualifies it as professional, what qualifies self-publication. It's a difficult issue. There was a time when the concept of a vanity press meant pure garbage and very little deviation from that. But now it's not simple.
Yeah. Now anybody can do that. Anybody can publish something on the Kindle platform. I've done it myself.
Uh-huh.
I am not rolling in dough because of it.
And anybody can put out an audiobook.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's got all kinds of questions.
I'm presuming, and I haven't delved into it, I'm presuming a publisher eventually picked up The Martian.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Same thing with 50 Shades eventually.
Yeah, I would, yes. That generally happens with the better self-published things. Let's look ahead a little. What movies are on the horizon?
Well, this weekend, this was one of the ones that I was looking forward to, Crimson Peak.
Right,
Guillermo del Toro returning to horror. And stylized period horror, apparently. So this is one I do want to check out. I definitely want to see it more than I want to see the Peanuts movie, which I think is opening this weekend. And I don't have it here, so I'm not sure if it was this past weekend or this weekend, but there was... No, I think it was this past weekend that Pan opened.
Yes, it's already opened.
Yeah.
I was amazed to find Anthony Lane in The New Yorker, the one critic who liked it.
I was actually very interested in seeing it because actually the director
Joe Wright
of it,
is an interesting director, no question.
Yeah. And it's Joe Wright who did it, and he actually did a very good film that slipped under the radar called Hannah, which was about this young girl who was raised as a super assassin who's on the run from a government agency. And
it may have slipped under the radar in terms of box office.
Yeah.
But I remember it's being reviewed by all the major media.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Didn't get much love. I think it should have gotten more love than it actually did.
Yeah.
Because it was actually a rather fascinating film with a very curious fairy tale feel about it, for all that. It has sort of this super spy espionage setting to it.
And from what I understand, credible martial arts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Done by the lead actress.
Yeah. Saoirse Ronan, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
So...
So I was curious about Pan, but everybody was, well, The Martian was the big draw. So I did want to see that. Crimson Peak is this weekend, and so definitely I'm getting to that.
Yeah, I like Del Toro. I have to say that I'm very critical of what are often other people's favorite works of his.
Well, there are two Del Toros. There's the Spanish, Mexican / Spanish Del Toro, the guy from Kronos,
mm-hmm.
and those films. And then there's the more, I guess the term would be pop culty Del Toro.
The Hobbit.
Of Hellboy.
I loved Hellboy. I
like Hellboy. I like the Hellboy films too, but I think Guillermo del Toro is a more interesting filmmaker.
Yeah.
And a deeper and more affecting filmmaker.
Yeah, everybody loved Pan's Labyrinth.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not.
Really? Why not? Because I loved it.
It could have been fixed with, I think, some simple rewrites. But first of all, I found it all terribly predictable from the beginning to where the end was going to go. And we're following classic fairy tale rules. And classic fairy tale rules are that a person is told, whatever you do, don't do blank. You know, don't look back or you'll lose your wife. it's the oldest thing in the book. But you always have to justify it somehow in your story. And in the third quest, where she is told, you know, she's not in there forever. She's told simply, don't eat anything. And there's a table of food, and the first thing she does, for no particular reason, we don't know that she's been starving or anything like that. She sees a sweet, and she eats it, and this kills her mother, and the whole movie falls apart. The whole story falls apart. The big question is, why? Del Toro never justifies it. There may be missing scenes, or there may be an alternate script.
Or maybe he hoped the style and the atmosphere would transcend logic.
Well, okay, you know, that's a problem. Because in both in fantasy, as much as in hard science fiction, your interior logic needs to be fairly rigid for it to be believable. And Pan's Labyrinth transcends, a lot of the basic grim tales and all that, but it follows the basic rules of classic fantasy, and then it breaks it. Mm-hmm. And he had me pretty much up to a point, but ultimately, I think that he dropped the ball. It may have been for studio purposes. I don't know. It may be on the cutting room floor. Again, I don't know. I suspect it isn't, because a movie that popular would have all of the cutting room floor materials out in Blu-ray. And it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So
I was able to go with him on it. At that point, well, for one thing, I didn't particularly detect any lapse in logic.
Most people weren't looking at it. They were thinking about the hands with the eyes, the beautiful art.
Again, the style.
Yeah, and that's the same thing.
And sometimes I can go with it. I agree with you. There are certain films where I can detect it's all style, and I can say this is bourgeois.
But that's how I also view Blade Runner.
Yeah, I can understand your reaction to that, too. I think it depends as much on what can compensate for that. If I feel that the characters transcended, if I feel that the style and the visual transcended, the mise-en-scène transcends it, then I can be more forgiving, perhaps, of lapses in logic. It's usually with film, they say you have to have there are three things that you can have. You can have the star, the director, and the script. Two of those have to be strong in order for a film to work, and maybe what I'm feeling is that particularly for a genre film, you have character, you have mise-en-scène, and you have story, and two of those maybe have to be strong enough for it to carry for me. So as another example, I was much more forgiving of the finale of Lost than a lot of people were, because I was invested in the characters and I liked the mise-en-scène.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, Lost is something that lost me, so.
Exactly, as it did a lot of people. And here again, I don't blame them for that. So let me ask you, while we're talking about films coming up, are you looking forward to Spectre?
Yes, but not to the degree that they're hyping it.
I don't
I look forward to any good Bond film, and I think that with Casino Royale, I think Paul Haggis did a tremendous job in rebooting it.
Yeah.
And he had a trilogy in mind, and he didn't get to finish the trilogy because he dropped out of Scientology. And that, you know, read the book or watch the movie Going
Clear. Oh, yeah, I know.
I mean, the timing, now nobody says that directly, but that's the timing. And it's not that the studio said, well, Quantum of Solace did such a little box office in comparison and didn't live up to it. The way I saw it is it was part two of a trilogy, and it had part two problems.
You know, that's the one that I've never seen. I'm not – every now and then I say, you know, I should watch that eventually, but I'm not particularly compelled. I'm not particularly overwhelmingly compelled to see, you know, the newest James Bond
Well, did movies. You see Skyfall?
Yeah, I did see Skyfall.
Which was just a substitute for Haggis's third film, although I think it went where Haggis was going.
Possibly.
But here's the thing. Casino Royale was a reboot. That's very important, that bringing in Daniel Craig, reinventing Bond, Casino Royale is his second case. And, you know, he's not this experienced agent. And it's only at the end of the first movie that he ever says Bond, James Bond. Then the second film starts adding some of the other trope elements. And the third film, which actually does happen in Skyfall, is supposed to bring it fully round to here's M, here's this, here's that, you know, because a new
and, M. And then essentially reinventing the franchise. Here's the
thing. But the point is that he did parts one and two. And he never got to do part three. So I think if people were to watch Casino Royale and follow it up with Quantum of Solace and imagine in your mind that this is a trilogy and that there's a third film, that third film never happened because by the time when we get to Skyfall and Neil Purvis and the other very talented writers who worked on it was Sam Mendes, the director, basically said, oh, this is no longer a reboot. We're back to the experienced Bond, which it was not in the other two.
The weird thing for me, and one more time, I stand outside of the majority here, is that I actually liked the first half of Skyfall, which was the more traditional James Bond type film than the second half, which was the point where the Bond franchise was being reinvented.
Yeah, or actually the backstory being filled out.
Yeah.
Which is more of what they're going to do in Spectre, by the way.
Yeah.
That's, you know, readily apparent from the commercials that I have seen, the trailers and all that. But it is so overhyped how many cars were destroyed and stuff like that. I really don't care. I don't
follow the publicity.
The possibly the best Bond films are from Russia with Love, which is a low-budget movie.
Low budget, low, and relatively low tech.
Yeah, relatively. There were gadgets.
Right.
And they were all, by the way, credible gadgets. It's not until Goldfinger that we start getting into that.
That we get hyperbolic, but it turns out that Goldfinger was essentially the film that set the Bond mold. Goldfinger was the film where everybody said, oh, look, here's James Bond.
And it's semi-science fiction, yes.
Yes.
But it's not like Dr. No from Russia with Love didn't do well.
That's true, too. But Goldfinger, third
Goldfinger
time's the
Goldfinger is
charm.
The gold standard, yes.
Yeah. So to speak.
Yeah. But having said, I could go on and on about Bond films, and I know my stuff on them pretty well. But it's not, It's fair to say, to a large extent, they are science fiction when they rely on such gadgetry and movies like Moonraker and stuff like that. It's clearly SF. Comedy SF.
Well, I don't know what the hell Moonraker is, actually, but
It's a parody. It's a parody of itself.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what. Yeah, that is what it is. Which is unfortunate because it followed up what was actually a pretty good James Bond.
Yeah, The Spy Who Loved Me was a pretty good film, movie.
Spy Who Loved Me.
Yep. About the only really good Roger Moore film.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Roger Moore Bond film, I should say.
Right.
But yeah, what else is, well, I mean, we, Star Wars, again, the overhype is killing me.
The overhype is killing me, and yet I am caught up in it anyway. Actually,
you know, they had all that hype for The Phantom Menace.
Yeah, it's true too, except for this, it is now in the hands of Disney. And Disney
more to the point, it's
does pretty well in making good, entertaining films out of franchises.
That is true. But the final cut actually belongs to J.J. Abrams.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I have a feeling about Abrams in general. You mentioned Lost. But, you know, take a look at Abrams and Star Trek, where he brings the best of it mm-hmm. to light, and it's only after this incredibly entertaining movie is over that you say, wait a minute, that made no sense.
It is true. I do not sniff at films that are merely entertaining. And
no, I don't. But
God knows, Star Wars is not supposed to be a deep think type of thing, despite what Lucas thinks. Lucas was never a deep think type of storyteller.
No, he wasn't a deep think type of storyteller. But they're not deep. His films aren't deep think movies. What they are pure myth and fantasy in the classic tradition. And he used that very, very well in the first two films. The third film, and by the third film, I mean Return of the Jedi, sort of drops down a little bit. And then the second trilogy, episodes 1, 2, and 3, 3 is pretty good. But they could have taken episodes 1 and 2, bundled them up in half an hour, tacked it onto 3, and had one good movie.
I actually take episode 2 over episodes 1 and 3.
Really?
Actually, okay. Yeah. I think they, except for the whole Anakin Skywalker feeling his rage and saying as much in so many words bits. But the rest of it, I thought, between the action and the storytelling and what they were doing with the larger universe and the mythology at that point, I actually felt that was the more interesting film. The first one, episode 1, and, you know, I had seen it when they had re-released it in a 3D version, and I said, well, you know, let's take a fresh look at it. And see, you know, now that we know what Lucas was trying to do, maybe there's something to see. No, it's a bad film.
Yeah, there's no way around that.
There's no way around that.
There's no way that this little white bread kid is going to become either Anakin Skywalker or Darth Vader or any of the above. And we won't even discuss Jar Jar. We don't have to. Without Jar Jar Binks, it still doesn't work.
No, it's a bad film all the way around. And yes, you're right. Even without Jar Jar Binks, it's just not good. And the third film, frankly, I don't remember enough of the third film.
You might actually want to give that another look. It actually does work on a Fable bases, which is, after all, what they are. And Star Wars is not science fiction. It's science fantasy, that grand old a blend of...
Which strictly speaking, as a category, did not exist until Star Wars.
Not true at all.
You don't think?
No, I don't. Since I have many issues of a magazine called Science Fantasy at home, that it was a pulp magazine, and there were some... It was a major subgenre of science fiction for 20 years.
Okay.
Easily. Including... A lot of the source material is Star Kings by Edmond Hamilton, which, if people read, it's a fairly obscure book, but if people read it, you will see a few of the things that Lucas took from. And then Edmond Hamilton's wife, somebody named Lee Brackett, just happened to write the screenplay for The Empire Strikes Back. She died, unfortunately, at an advanced age. And Lawrence Kasdan finished it off. But this is not coincidence. Science fantasy was, you know, the very much what was going on in the 30s and 40s in what later on got to be called sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
What us cognoscenti called SF. So, yeah, I think science fantasy very much did exist. It's what Lucas pulled from. You know, Flash Gordon, what's that?
Well, yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll grant you that. Grant you that. Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All that stuff. All that stuff of the 30s and 40s. And
John Carter.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay, yeah. I concede. I give on this one.
Yeah, so, you know, not saying it's better or anything like that, just saying it's an old, honored tradition in science fiction, and Lucas mined it, and he mined it very well. He got it down to the side sweeps, and for that, Ron really needs to, as far as I'm concerned, there's only one film called Star Wars that people later on called A New Hope.
Yeah.
And of course, I saw it, maybe a dozen times in the theater before those words, A New Hope, were ever in it.
Mm-hmm. That film is unique. It is singular if you compare it to the other films in the franchise.
Yeah, I mean...
Because nobody bleeping knew at that point that there was going to be a franchise.
Yeah.
Most people involved with the production, if you would ask them at that point, said, you know, this is going down the crapper.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw a preview or snippets and a talk at the 1970 Worldcon, Mid-Americon in Kansas City. Mid-Americon 2 is next year. I'm going to go one of my first Worldcons in... 15 years. And Lucas was there and did a presentation on what he was planning. Mm-hmm. And the description of the movie was pretty much, well, you have a princess who is being... looked over. You have a princess who needs rescuing, a young man who does not realize that he is a budding wizard being helped by a chief wizard to accomplish the ends. That's the plot. And it fits.
Right.
And when people heard Lucas's description, we didn't get it, and then we saw pictures and thought, okay, we'll see. And he did pull it off.
Yeah, he did. But nobody knew it, not even Lucas. The account in Raging Bulls and Easy Riders, or it's either Easy Riders and Raging Bulls or Raging Bulls and Easy Riders.
Mm-hmm.
The crew hated Lucas. Lucas hated the crew. Everybody hated the movie. And from one account that I did hear, the executives at 20th Century Fox thought the film was going to tank. They thought their big hit was going to be Damnation Alley. You know, the, Jan Michael Vincent yeah. Fighting
no,
giant cockroaches.
I think people knew better than that because it was on the cover of Time and Newsweek before it opened.
Was it?
Yeah, it was. I still have my copy of Time magazine from them. No, it was very, very quiet. And then when it opened big.
Yeah.
At what, in like three theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And before, I went to a 9 a.m. screening.
Mm-hmm.
And for the 11:30 screening, there were lines all the way around the block. There were no reviews yet.
Mm-hmm.
So they pretty much had an idea. They may have been keeping it to themselves to an extent, but people had seen more than the rushes. And they were still, you know, throwing the movie together like the day before it came out.
Yeah.
But
and I'll tell you this. I saw the film. I was stoned out of my mind when I saw the film. Which is probably the best way to see it anyway.
Yeah.
But when you got that fantastic fanfare, which you had not heard in a science fiction film for decades. And then you had that opening crawl that receded into the background, and I started laughing like hell because right at that point, immediately I knew what Lucas was trying to do. That was the same type of crawl that they used in the Flash Gordon serials.
Exactly. And people of a certain age, which certainly includes me, always talk about they know where they were at certain key moments in their life. They talk about they know where they were when they heard about the Kennedy assassination. And the one that I always throw out is, assuming that you saw it in a theater, in a proper theater, everybody remembers where they were and who they were with and the day. The first time the Imperial cruiser went over their head 3 minutes into that movie.
Did your auditorium applaud? Mine did.
No, it was silent. You could hear the gasp. You could hear everybody going.
Well, everybody in my theater must have been stoned too then.
Oh, we I'm not. I don't think that we weren't not stoned, mm-hmm. but I think that it was literally too breathtaking. We had never seen anything like it before.
Yeah.
And how far into the run did you see it?
Opening night.
Okay, opening morning.
It was the first day.
Okay, yeah. So the word was out. I went to first screening.
Ah.
Because Hour of the Wolf ended at 7 a.m. And Margot Adler and her husband John and WBAI grand personality Gary Fried and I went to the early morning screening. And it was not full at all at was it the Ziegfeld or was it the Los Astor Plaza?
It was the Astor Plaza.
Yeah, it was the Los Astor Plaza. And we sat there through they still didn't go around throwing you out. And I watched most of New York science fiction fandom file in. Chairs, all the chairs around us, mm-hmm. by the first reasonable time screening, word was out.
By the time I got there, and this was the night of the debut screening. So opening night, if you will.
Yeah.
But they were handing out May the Force Be With You buttons.
Oh, yes. They had the merchandising in place to begin
with.
They had an idea of what they had.
Yeah. At that point, they did.
Yeah. So didn't take long. But yes, Disney has a way of reviving certain things and doing a pretty good job nowadays. They've also dropped the ball on a few things.
The Marvel films run hot and cold.
For the most part, I like them, even the mediocre ones. Only one I haven't seen is Ant-Man.
Ant-Man is a lot of fun.
Yeah,
The Thor films I tend to think are the ones that crater most seriously.
Yeah, and yet on second viewing, I enjoy them even more watching for all the S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff. If you're a fan at all of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., rewatch Thor. And you'll see all the groundwork in there, including the Glenn Paulson character and all that stuff being opened up, and it all ties together rather nicely. They were very good about that in building their Marvel Cinematic Universe, and now I guess to an extent includes the TV universe.
Yeah.
And what is in Thor is very much what's in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah. I keep watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and I keep hoping, and sometimes it pays off, sometimes it doesn't. My feeling about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is this is the universe where Thor exists, and Iron Man exists, and Captain America exists. Why am I hanging around with these people?
Well, I like them.
Yeah.
What can I say? And I'm not necessarily, the big Marvel fan.
I keep hoping the first episode felt more promising than the subsequent episodes that I've seen.
Well, the problem is, and this is true with a lot of serial television, is that one tends not to lead well to the next season, that is. And what they've been doing with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is it's all getting ready to tie into another movie, which, by certain accounts, has been canceled. The movie The Inhumans.
I hadn't seen that it had been canceled. Isn't it supposed to tie in? Captain America film, isn't that next in the sequence?
Yes, Inhumans was about 2 or 3 years from now.
Yeah, right.
But the TV series is very much about the Inhumans and leading up to that, and Guardians of the Galaxy has mention of it.
Right.
And there's actually connectivity between Guardians of the Galaxy and stuff in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I went on an insane thing. I actually watched the entire, with the exception of Ant-Man, because it hadn't opened at that point, I've watched the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe from its earliest beginning, which I guess is Thor, I don't count the Hulk, to the present.
Yeah, Thor is about right, actually.
Yeah, it works pretty well. Then there is the problem that we discuss every time Chris Claremont is on the show, and that is how they will never be able to tie X-Men and the X-Men universe into the Avengers universe due to contractual problems. So that's why the Inhumans were created. The Inhumans are the X-Men. Notice that on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and in the movies, they never even use the word mutant.
They're legally not permitted to. I know that.
Yeah, I don't know why.
There is a jurisdictional dispute, and this was the thing that happened when both X-Men and the Avengers wanted to use the same character.
Which they have done.
Quicksilver, I believe.
Yes, and it would seem like they created a poison pill when they killed Quicksilver off in the Disney universe, but he's very much alive in the X-Men universe.
Yeah.
We are out of time, Dan.
Oh, dear. And we never got around to talking about Kung Fu Panda 3.
Ah, well, that's inevitable.
It'll have to be the next time.
I guess so. So thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay, take good care.
You too.
Okay. And, oh, don't forget, Dan, not on next week, the week after.
Okay, I'll hold everything until then.
Okay, very good. Have a good morning.
You too.
Okay. And thank you, everybody. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and I'll be here in 2 weeks for our All Hallows Eve spectacular, and I hope and trust that you will be joining us. Stay tuned. Yes, in fact, Lister will not be here this morning. Oh, listen to Skype sighing its way out. And but we have wonderful pre-recorded programs for you to listen to. Everybody, be good to each other. Take good care. If you care to write me, I've been neglectful of Facebook as of late because, well, I'm darned busy with some very cool stuff, actually. And, oh, next week at KGB Fantastic Fiction, Fran Wilde and Nathan Ballengrud, two people you don't want to miss. So look that up, Google that up, and enjoy. Please, everybody, be good to each other, and we'll talk in 2 weeks. Take good care.
I must be kind to myself, so me can be kind to myself. I must be kind to my heart, so my heart can be kind to me. Now, if you would repeat those words, then I would like to repeat after you. I must be kind to my heart can be kind to me. I must be kind to my pancreas glands, so my pancreas can be kind to me and I do not get diabetes. I must be kind to my kidneys, so my kidneys can be kind to me, so I don't end up with dialysis. I must be kind to my blood so my blood can be kind to me so I don't end up with blood pressure medications and get into all kinds of trouble. We have 2 hours, and we are going to spend these 2 hours on these simple questions. And our regular listeners really even know that the simple questions call for simple answers. And I know that many of you, if you were in the studio and the mic was yours for some time, you would also say the words, speak the words that would resonate with me. I must be kind to my body so my body can be kind to me. I must be kind to my heart so my heart can be kind to me. I must be kind to my kidneys so my kidneys can be kind to me. Welcome to Science, Health, and Healing, Professor Dr. Janet Coleman.
I'm just adjusting my nurse's cap right now and my professor's robe. Welcome, Dr. Ali.
You know, I taped some programs on MNN television yesterday evening, and I wanted to devote one full program to salute the professionals, most importantly the nurses, the physicians, the people involved in the care of people afflicted with Ebola in the United States, more importantly in West Africa. Doctors have taken a lot of abuse. I've been watching, listening to these people, and it is frustrating, because I think people, when they want to express their opinion, they should really tell their credentials. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I started my work yesterday by saying I am a pathologist. I was a pathologist for 29 years. I did a lot of autopsies on people dying of viral infections. In 2006, I published my book, The Rooster Bird Flu, An Imperial Medicine of the New Empire. That book was about 1918 Spanish flu, which rightfully should be called American flu, because it started in Kansas. And then it crossed the pond and went over to Europe. It was World War I. And then it took the lives of all 4 female members of my grandfather's family. All male members escaped, including my father. I think people who really have not taken care of very ill people, critically ill people with the saliva and the vomitus and the diarrhea and the perspiration. You know, when you are dying and you have blood in your lungs, you're going to cough up blood. Mm-hmm. And that blood is going to be rich, rich, rich with virus particles. So let us salute those 2 nurses who became sick. I can only imagine. And then we continue to send, and that's the great, you know, greatest admiration for those Americans who are going there, the Europeans who are going there, the Doctors Without Borders who are going there. I mentioned last time that the most critical part of treatment, from my perspective, and I've given my credentials, I would agree with everything they are doing, including heparin as blood thinner, but I would have hoped, but I know they're not going to do it. Intravenous hydrogen peroxide, intravenous ED acylation, intravenous vitamin C, some hydrogen peroxide foot soaks on their legs. See, hydrogen peroxide is very good in activating the oxygen systems which kill off. So somebody who is not familiar with it would say, well, come on, Dr. Ali, you don't understand. Ebola creates blisters and the skin is dying and you want to do peroxide foot soak. Oh, yes, sir, I know my business. Hydrogen peroxide works. The idea that hydrogen peroxide does kill viruses directly, the 3% that we commonly use, that's erroneous. What hydrogen peroxide does in extremely small amounts is it activates certain enzymes in the immune hunter cells, and they kill off the viruses. And so you need extremely low. I'm talking about one part out of a million parts that hydrogen peroxide is effective. So whether you do the soaks or the better still, the intravenous hydrogen peroxide. I say this because I think I predicted it will come to United States. It did. Ironically, I did predict in my Manhattan MNN television program back in early part of July, I did a series, it will definitely come to United States, and I thought it will come from West Africa to Europe and then Europe to America. That's what happened. When I heard President Obama say that it is extremely unlikely that it will come, I said, who is advising him? When I heard him say that we can cope with it, who is advising him? You know, if you read only very brief accounts of 1918 American flu, let's call it for what it is. It was an American flu. And 50 to 100 million people died. Things can get out of control. I was especially offended by the New York Times report, I think last week, on the front page. Somebody from Bellevue is saying, oh, we are well prepared for Obama. No, you're not. So I read that, and I wanted to know what could be the basis of such an absurd position right on New York Times front page. Well, they said because we have 4 isolation beds ready at Bellevue Hospital. I think New York City now is 8.5 million people, and then add some more to Metropolitan. So what should we do? I think that panic clearly is going to be unkind to your heart and unkind to your blood, and it will create problems. I think that whenever politicians try to soft pedal the things, they always create problems. Their effort should have been, we are going to do our best. Ebola has been devastating in West Africa. It is going to reach here. And yes, we will make mistakes. I think it is outrageous to expect that the doctors who have no experience with dealing with this kind of a disease are going to be criticized by a television pundit. Yeah. That's just so, you know, it just offends you. So how do you walk this tightrope that we don't panic and close up all the schools in Ohio? And how are we aware to what can we do? Most of all, what is my responsibility to myself and to my community? Okay. Mr. Duncan clearly lied. I do not believe that Mr. Duncan did not know when he was in Africa that he transported someone who died literally before him, and to say that someone is traveling international and he doesn't know what's happening in Liberia, that's nonsense. So he knew. I believe that he came to the United States because he thought he would have better treatment here. Okay? Then he lied to people that he was not exposed to that, etc. So what do we do? I think our responsibility is to our community, to ourselves, to our country, that we are forthright. And I also have little comfort from the statement that they keep giving, oh, it's not infected unless you are symptomatic. That is such, I mean, anybody who understands viruses, you hear this and you say, what could be the scientific basis of ever making a statement? First, they're saying that you are not infective unless you have symptoms. That means the virus is in your body. Otherwise, you wouldn't make a statement like that. Now, the virus is going to multiply, and it's going to create fever and the diarrhea, vomiting, the hemorrhages, the clotting, the rest of the story. This statement that people are not infective until they have fever, I am absolutely certain that if you go to West Africa, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and if you ask the people there, they will tell you this is not true. Okay, so this is also, why not accept the truth and then bring in an element of philosophic equilibrium, a spiritual equilibrium, compassion for other people, compassion for ourselves. I believe that all the nonsense which was fed to this primarily was motivated, we don't want panic. And ironically, that's exactly what they did. If they had explained these things to people, I think people intuitively know when they're lied to. And, I think this is true, that President Roosevelt, during the polio epidemic, he gave dozens and dozens, probably more than 100 direct press conferences, because he took on this responsibility. I am going to be forthright with Americans. I'm going to call it the way it is, and we are going to together deal with it. So I think it should be a national resolve, not lying and not belittling this, just calling it for what it is. Could it be a devastating thing? Yes. Is it likely that it is going to be a devastating problem in the United States? Probably not. Why? Because I think that we in America we have a lot of bleach, for example. Mm-hmm. Okay? We can, you know, they're talking about having 2 or 3 centers for Ebola. That, again, that's not going to work. Okay?
You need them locally, you mean?
You and me to be locally.
Yeah.
And there should be intensive training, which now they are doing. Okay? Mm-hmm. I don't really hold doctors responsible for whatever happened. I don't hold nurses responsible. That's why I went out of the way. Mm-hmm. And I want to use this time to let's salute together all the professionals